Looking for more than just pain relief? At Ability Chiropractic, they help your body do what it was designed to do, heal naturally. Their doctors focus on spinal and nervous system alignment to restore balance, energy, and overall wellness. From infants to grandparents, families across Columbus are discovering that true healing starts from within, not from a prescription bottle. Experience what natural healing can do for you. Book your appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Today's episode of the Inside EVs podcast is brought to you by E-Range EV Tire. E-Range EV tires are specifically engineered for electric vehicles. Using an advanced manufacturing process called liquid phase mixing, E-Range EV's EcoPoint 3 technology creates a tire with lower rolling resistance and longer range, while offering low levels of wear and high grip. All this while staying affordable. Go to erangetires.com. That's E-R-A-N-G-E tires.com to find your EV's next set of tires.
It's Friday, the 23rd of February, and because it's a Friday, it means it's Inside EV's podcast day. Welcome, friends, to a whole world of fun and exciting EV news, reviews, and commentary. As ever, I am your host, Alex Goy, joined by the wonderful Lacey, Misco Electric, Hazel Southwell, and the boss man, Patrick George. How are we, friends? How have our weeks been?
Wonderful.
Yeah, good. Good.
Doing great, Alex. It was a very busy week of news and stories on the site, which we're going to talk about in a bit. And I have a rousing nap planned for this weekend after all of it. So thrilled to be here and power through Friday with you all, as always.
After a busy week of providing the world with glorious, glorious EV content, you are treating yourself to a nap.
To sleep, yes. Yes,
to exactly. Sleep.
To a recharge.
Yes.
Yeah. Recharge. See, there I like go. That.
Very I don't get it.
You know, there'll be someone out there who'll be like, why are they saying it's the recharge? That's what sleep is. Anyway, without further ado, let's crack on with some EV news.
EV news.
There has been lots on this week. We have cherry-picked some of the most beautiful stories out there. But we're going to start with the Honda Prologue. Now, Inside EV's very own Kevin Williams wrote an absolutely glorious review that made me feel very happy, but also quite old all at once. Because, it seems to Kevin that 2003, the early aughts are coming back because Honda and GM has teamed up to create a car, as they did with the Saturn View, I believe, in 2003. The Prologue, we've talked about it before, but here are the headlines. It's based on the Blazer, just the Ultium platform. Honda's basically, it's kind of an admission that, like a lot of Japanese manufacturers, Honda's a little bit behind the curve when it comes to developing EVs and creating a car that fits, you know, the current lust or want there is for EVs. In the US, you will get a front or all-wheel drive setup. Now, on the launch, he drove the 288 horsepower, 85 kilowatt hour batteried all-wheel drive car. Prices range between $45,000 and $65,000. The range that it was quoted for this car is 281 miles, just a couple more than the Blazer upon which it is based. It can charge between 20 and 80% in about 35 minutes on 150 kilowatt hour fast charge. Exterior looks good. The interior, Kevin had some comments on. The software it's running appears to be different. I also think the rear looks like a Mark 1 Range Rover Evoque, but that might just be me. And
it's very Kevin, generous, like, I think.
It's a little bit. It's sort of what someone would draw. If someone said, draw the original Evoque, and they'd be like, yeah, kind of that. Kevin had some comments on the ride being a little bit better than the Blazer. The important thing to note here is that Kevin was on the launch. This was in Napa Valley in California, so the weather was good. The conditions were right for the battery. Everything was as shiny as it can be. Bear in mind, though, the last time Kevin got into a Blazer, it kind of ate itself. So we'll give it a shout. What do we think, friends? First of all, I loved this review. I love Kevin's writing. It's awesome. If you haven't read it, please do. It's beautiful. Yep. But it will.
We feel old because, you know, I remember being a high schooler in the early 2000s and right after 9/11 in America, being like, man, this time sucks. No one's ever going to be nostalgic for this time in history. And Kevin's story is it's 2003 again. IMAX are really, really hot with the kids, and the kids are wearing JNCOs and Juicy Couture, and Usher's back. Usher's doing the Super Bowl. And I'm like, oh, my God, how'd this happen? So no offense to Usher, who's unbelievably talented and deserves, you know, the accolades he gets. But it's an interesting car. I'm really excited to chat about this week and get this group's thoughts on it. I love this blue that they advertise so heavily with and that they put in all the press photos. It's a really nice shade of blue. Beyond that, it's kind of mid, as the teens say, the prologue. I'm with it. I googled that an hour before this podcast started.
Next week we call an EV loud.
Yeah. Oh god, is that's a thing too, I guess. It's in terms of specs and everything, it's very solidly mid-pack. There's nothing just world killer about this thing. But in our drive, and also a freelancer who wrote for us, Michael Betancourt in Canada, they fast charged it, which we should talk about later too, did not have the catastrophic failure at the fast charger that put Kevin, to go rent a pickup truck to drive home. It worked fine. So that bodes well for the Honda Prelude. I'm sorry. I've done that several times this week. The Honda Prologue, a different thing. But what do we think of this fine electric crossover from Honda and their pals at General Motors?
I mean, as from what I've read and from what I've seen, I dig a bit of really smart badge engineering. If you're going to do it, Honda is well aware that it doesn't have the chops just yet. It's got the ENY1 over here, which is not reviewing brilliantly. I had a quick spin in it a couple of months back, and it was, a slab of car on a prescribed route. It was okay, yeah. But people have had it for more time. We're like, no, this is pretty awful, actually. I really don't like it. It's not imaginative. It's not exciting. It's just an car, and it's not very good at doing that. By the sounds of this...
And the name Honda's- is awful.
And, sorry, and the name
throw that in there.
That's that entirely fine. The name is pretty terrible. It doesn't sound like anyone's buying it. But I like the fact that Honda's kind of embracing in this case that it is an car, but it's taken GM's version and gone, how can we make this slightly more us? How can we make it better? The fact that it didn't explode on him is good. The fact that the software seems to work a little better is great. I did note that he wasn't a huge fan of the interior because Honda's best efforts to Hondaize GM's work, they an attempt was made. It looks good.
They have changed up the homework a little bit, but it's not, I mean... I think to significantly Hondaize it would probably cost too much for it to be sensible.
Yeah, and GM's saying they want to make 40,000 of these a year, which is quite a lot, but we're going to talk about GM's woes a bit later. But Patrick and Lacey, as our resident Americans, if one of these was offered to you or you saw one of these, what would your initial thoughts be? Would you be like, yes, that's a fine automobile? Or would you go, well, I had toast for breakfast. I've had enough beige for the day.
I love toast. So there's that. But I just think that this is exactly what it needs to be, minus the fact that it is a little expensive, but that's the story of EV still right now. So I actually really like that it's bland. It's not offensive at all to me. And I like that they have allowed you to get Android Auto and Apple CarPlay, because in this age people are still really wanting that, and I think that that's the perfect idea for the type of person for this car, which I think is a transition to a first-time EV buyer who is just needing a car that looks and feels like a more traditional, which this is along the lines of how I described the Nissan Ariya when I did my review on that, is that
yes,
it's not super high tech, which is perfect for people that aren't into that to get into, but still use it and be user friendly, but have the tech that you want enough to feel comfortable transitioning. And I like that the charging rate is, I think, a minimum of 150 kilowatts this day and age, especially for this price point, is like a requirement. But I think that's fine. Obviously, I haven't seen the charging curve, but we've heard that, you know, better charging experience, of course, is really nice. But I think that, you know, sub 300 miles of range is, you know, going to be just fine for most people that buy this. And I'm really happy that Honda realized that they needed to do something in order to get an EV in the US market like ASAP. And the ZDX rides on the same platform too. So that'll be the more luxurious version. So we'll see price point wise, like how that's comparable. But to me, this is like very similar to the Aria in that regard, that it's not offensive at all, a little expensive, but it's fine. And I think this, will this qualify for credits because it's built in Mexico? So North American.
I believe it will. I don't think that's official yet, but we expect that it will. I think
so. That's
a
bonus off of the Aria can only get it through the lease loophole because it's made in Japan. So
no, that's a really great point. Like they, it's definitely of the moment. Like you said, like get something out now. And I think, you know, take advantage of those tax credits, which a lot of players like Nissan them were not able to do because some of those rules were put in place after their production plans were underway. But they make a good case for this thing. It's like there's two ways you could go with your EV, right? You could do the crazy spaceship, like an Ioniq 5 maybe or something, or you could say to your customers, like, look, this is basically the same crossover from us that you loved before, except now it runs on batteries. And like both of those are smart approaches. And not every EV needs to be a spaceship. And it's sized really well. Like we had one of our YouTube commenters asked, you know, can you have somebody stand close to it? It's impossible to understand the scale. I think it's a pretty decently big crossover, actually. You know, it's two row, it's not three row, but I mean, it's a big, like tall, wide, long thing. Like first time I saw this was in Japan last year, actually. And it was sitting on a display stand amid all Honda's K cars and motorcycles and scooters. I was like, boy, this big American boy stand out, you know?
You know what they should do, actually, is they should include the Moto Compacto with this car to make
it
like
awesome. Oh my God.
Like inclusive because it's already expensive. And in my opinion, the Moto Compacto is way too expensive for what it is, but it is so cool looking and could fit perfectly in the trunk of the car.
How much is it?
It's like over $1,000 and it only goes 12 miles.
Absolutely.
Or somewhere
not.
Around
$1,000.
Which is I review e-bikes and scooters. So for me, I'm like, that is insane, but it is really cool and it looks cool. And, you know, if you're a professional that wants to just take it as like a briefcase because it folds really nicely, then that kind of makes sense. But they should throw that in as like, you're also going to get this. Oh, another thing that I really like about the Prologue is that they're doing this three option purchase program where you can either choose from, I think it's like a charging portable charger / level 2 charger and the installation of it. You could get credits for Electrify America, or you can get, sorry, what was the third thing? Does anybody remember? There's like three options that you can choose from. And I think that's really smart for them to be able to, you know, add that as like another bonus of you're buying the car. So you get your choice of these three items to enhance your ownership experience.
That's a great approach from them. That's really smart. Like these automakers have got to stop with the free fast charging thing, because I think it's creating this whole world of problems, lines at chargers, dependency on DC fast charging that they didn't really anticipate happening. And it's like, if you go out of your way to give people home charging options for a car like this, and I bet you most of the people that buy this thing are single family homeowners, you know, probably in the suburbs or something like this, that, you know, you keep that customer for life, I think. And right. you really make their lives easier than having to wait at the EA station. Like just too many people in America are doing to refuel their cars.
Yeah. And just to have a choice is, I think, really smarter than I'm just trying to look it up to see exactly what it is, because I'm sorry.
It's something we've talked about before. It's the, you know, a lot of people could have a plug at home but don't, or a lot of people are trying to at the moment trying to use those big fast public chargers as they would.
Even people who do have plugs at home are trying to use the faster ones, or like because the perception is that this is more efficient, or that you shouldn't leave the car, because there is also the issue of people understand you shouldn't leave the car plugged in too long, but it's like, but that isn't the case when it's charging slower. You can leave the car plugged in overnight for that, or like whatever. And I think, yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions about charging and like how to best preserve your battery, and especially that like these specialist charging stations might not actually be the best thing to plug your car into.
Yeah. Well, yeah, with battery degradation and queues and expense, it's really expensive in some cases. Like the one around the corner from me, it's like, oh, I want a full battery. Okay, that's 50 quid. Pardon? I had to wait half an hour, 40 minutes for this privilege? Ace, thanks very much. You know, it's a matter of looking at use cases. Anyway, Lacey, have you found your third bit of the
package? Sorry.
I threw something in the chat, Lacey, I think, if you want to read that off. Yeah, I put this in the chat if you want to read that off since you brought this up.
Oh, the package includes a 11.5 kilowatt home charging station, a $500 installation incentive, and a 100 public charging credit. So you can pick between the three of them. You know,
which is
I don't
really
know.
Great.
Yeah, I think it's a great option, especially, you know, there are some incentives to get home stations installed that are subsidized by the government, but it's good that they give all three of these options, because maybe you don't road trip a lot, so you wouldn't use the public charging and you would want to have the more expensive installation or whatnot credited.
Yeah, I'm this has been on my mind a lot lately, because I've been writing a story about this, but like this whole, I think we've just really over indexed in America on like the road trip with EVs, and it's like, you know, not just range, but like DC fast charging, that's all great, we need all that stuff long term. But like we've got to rebalance this equation a bit and think more about the value of slower charging and the fact that you can buy a car that you will wake up to, the battery is basically full every single morning, and it's way cheaper. And like we are just, I don't think enough of that benefit. The best thing about EVs is being emphasized right now, to the car's detriment, because God knows they could use some positive press after lately, I think, you know.
I can't wait for the day where like 22 kilowatt charging is like the standard for everything, and then there's bi-directional charging on all EVs. Like that's when it's really going to provide so much value for people, is maximizing those higher AC charging rates.
When every week we're talking about virtual power plants at last, which is a nice segue into the next topic.
Yeah, well, let's move on to, well, we talked about GM. Let's talk about GM. So this week on the site, John Volker wrote an incredible essay, I guess, into GM's woes about how and why its EV strategy hasn't gone brilliantly. Kind of my highlights of it is they promised they'd do 400,000 EVs in 2023, but it only managed just shy of 14,000. There's lots of delays. The cars that GM builds in China are a lot, they're actually there, they exist largely because they don't use they use BYD cells. They also there was the fact that their engineers, they decided to do it all in house, but all of the engineers who've been working on it are now retiring, because why wouldn't they? But they're still hoping to produce 200,000 to 300,000 EVs in 2024, plus 40,000 Honda Prologue, Preludes, Gennaro boxes. Patrick, you're the man who commissioned this. It's incredible. Like,
thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, John did a marvelous job with this story. If you follow EV news at all, you've assuredly read John's work in this field. He's an OG at it. He was writing about this stuff you know, long before it was mainstream and cool, and he's a fantastic reporter, like a wonderful human to work with too. He's like, John's one of my favorite people, but he knocked this out of the park. And the reason that we did this is we've all known for a while that the GM Ultium EV stuff has not been going well. That's, you know, sales aren't where they want to be. There's been so many delays, stop sale orders, software glitches, the thing that happened to Kevin that you mentioned. But it's sort of like, what went wrong exactly? Like, what happened has really been a kind of a guarded secret within GM. It's like they've alluded to in like their earnings calls, the problem with like a battery, they're the supplier that does their battery assembly. They had problems there. But beyond that, we didn't really know what exactly went wrong. I think John got closer to nailing this than anybody did. It says a lot about where this company needs to, pardon my dog in the background, anyone listening to this.
He's just excited about GM strategy.
He is.
He's a GM shareholder, and he's very upset about these recent developments, and he gets very animated about this stuff. But it just shows that I think the biggest mistake that General Motors made, something you alluded to a moment ago, Alex. It's that classic GM insularity here, that everything that comes from within us is better than outside of us because it is, because we're GM. And it's astounding to me that attitude kind of still exists in that company, even after everything, even today. And they probably should have turned to more outside help and tech help and like poached Tesla people or gone to like battery supplier companies. But with software and batteries, they were like, no, we got this. We can do it ourselves. And it proved to be like one of the biggest headaches they've ever had. And it seems like they're reversing course on a lot of that right now.
I mean, it's sort of a bizarre arrogance of, well, we're the general. We can do anything we set our mind to. Forgetting, I think part of me thinks it was this moment of, okay, we're General Motors. We've made cars since forever. So it's just a car with a battery, right? We can do all of this in-house. And yet no one thought about what that actually meant. So instead just went barreling in and thought, well, we got this. We're fine. We can do it. Tesla can do it. We can do it. Tesla had a massive head start because there was a lot of bet hedging going, well, EVs won't last. EVs aren't the future. Why should we bother with this? Or if there is investment in it, it's like where they had the Volt, that sort of the PHEV. And then, yeah, the Bolt is the one that was doing great guns for them, which they're not selling anymore.
I'll bring this up real quick, too, is that, you know, you might read this story, but like, well, how have you had so many production issues? Like the Bolt had some recalls and stuff and some unfortunate fires, but it did fine, right? And that's a wonderful car. It's one of the best EVs I think ever made for many reasons. So it's like, well, you know, LG did those battery cells, you know, same with the Volt PHEV. It's like that's why it worked better. It was like they went to a company that like knew what it was doing in this space, as opposed to kind of outsourcing it to a supplier that seemingly did not, you know?
Yeah, they did the all encompassing. LG did the cells and they did the module production and the whole thing. So that's the difference here. And I think that's an important thing to point out, is because this supplier who has the automation to put these packs together, is this machine or whatever that they were talking about in John's article, is that this is a third party supplier that has done a lot of industrial applications, but they haven't necessarily done EV battery manufacturing. So I think that's like was so underestimated in this case that they wouldn't have the issues that they had, because they just are going with their traditional supplier relationships that they've had maybe in the past. And I think that is like the problem is not only what you were saying, Patrick, with like having this mentality of like, oh no, you know, we're the old guard and we are great within our organization and we have people that have worked here for 30 some odd years. And, you know, sometimes that is very great to have that experience. But when you're going into a new realm of building your own modules, like LG's still doing the cells, but then to take control of that, I get it. You have to save costs somewhere and do some things on your own. So I'm assuming that that will help them cost cut, especially for the volume that they want to produce. But the fact that you're going to rely on people that haven't done this before, from what I'm seeing and reading in these articles, is like, yeah, no, that's not a good approach.
So now the question becomes, you know, how does General Motors come back from this? And like, they say that they've got the automation issue solved. Like they're committing to these huge targets. They're like, we're going to do 200K plus this year and it's going to be profitable. Like they say they've got it fixed. And I think that they know this is make or break for them. I mean, frankly, we call it sometimes the EV slowdown. More technically, it's like the rate of EV adoption is slowing a bit. that may have bought GM some time to get it together, as opposed to, like, you know, the if somehow, like, last year and this year were, like, just explosive up to the right growth like they wanted, they really would have been left in the dust. But it's like maybe now they have a minute to catch up, and maybe that's not the worst thing for them.
Would that slowdown, like, well, oh, we're catching up during this slowdown, would consumers go, well, hang on, while you were figuring this out, these guys have overtaken you. We know that theirs aren't going to explode. But your Ultium cars, you took extra time. How do we know you've done the right job?
I think much more damaging in terms of if they get up to speed, if they get a full production line of these EVs out, if they start pumping out the models in the way that they announced that they were going to. That was the plan with Ultium, especially if they start, you know, doing the Ultium Home, the Ultium Industrial applications, because Ultium was meant to be this vast suite of things. Is that what they've shown in the past 18 months is that they can't deliver it. Now, they could throw out all their, I think it's ATS they were using, industrial assembly robots, or industrial automation robots, and get ABB ones in next week. ABB, almost any factory you walk into that's assembling batteries at the moment will have ABB robots. And they could get that production line going as fast as it possibly can. But the perception will be that there are people who put down an order for a Chevy Silverado EV years ago and are probably, like, there's still kind of like question marks about, like, what it, like, there are companies that can get away with having a car that doesn't arrive for a really long time and none of their names are GM, and this is something
this is
something that has been really frustrating people about gas cars, and it's something like any automotive journalist that covers the US will have been contacted by, like, owner groups saying, like, hey, my truck is sitting somewhere, and, like, hey, why haven't all of these things been finished? And for a long time, you could say it's the chips crisis, it's all these things, it's out of the control of the automaker. When people know it is actually fully in control of the automaker, and it is that their factory didn't function, that's really damaging. And again, it's the kind of thing where it doesn't damage Tesla, because Tesla are a big disruptive startup, and so obviously their assembly line is crazy, and they didn't have the right robots.
And they're building most of their components on their own. They're building most of their stuff on their own. So they're vertically integrated like nobody else in the business.
Yeah, which is, it's like they almost like lucked into that in some ways. Like when they set out to do the Model S, it's like, well, we don't have any of the stuff that would make this car work the way we want. I guess we're going to make it all ourselves. And it just kind of went from there. And it's weirdly proved to be like Tesla's like greatest strength. And I was sort of wondering, because GM will not say which battery assembly supplier is having these issues.
Automation machine,
They will not say which company this is, interestingly enough. And I wondered, like, why go with that supplier? Was it a low bid contract? Did you have some other agreement with this company that was like, for 80 years we have to go to them for X and we have no choice?
Are they genuinely not saying it? Because
that's
like,
correct. Yeah,
it's really easy to find this one out.
You'd think. I mean, I know Volker questioned them repeatedly on this. He told me this and he wrote it in the story.
Maybe it's not ATS. I don't want to necessarily implicate them, but
no,
like,
totally.
They are like 100% announced by them as the cell modular assembly partner for all of Ultium.
I'd have to look into that for sure, because I think that they just don't want to throw this company under the bus, which is understandable. It's kind of considered bad form in the auto industry to blame your suppliers for, you know, a car that ultimately has your name
supplying things.
But presumably they're supplying what best they can. It's just that neither party quite knows what is required in order to do this. And it's because of everything that we've just been talking about, is because they haven't worked with people who have the experience of setting up these production lines, is because they're not working with a company that has the experience of setting up those production lines, is because they've invented their own Ultium thing. And although they're working with LG, they're Ultium is a joint venture. Even though it's GM's, it's also LG's, it's also Samsung's. Somewhere along the way, this is just not working. And a production line can only be what you spec it out to be. And it feels like personally, if I was GM, which I'm obviously not, I would
giant multinational automotive conglomerate in human form? I'm amazed. Every week on this podcast, we learn something new about you, Hazel. And this week,
you told me you were assembling a Chevy Trax by hand yourself this morning.
Oh, well, I am doing that, but that's just the import market in Europe. I would right now be rebranding Altium. I would be doing something about this because, like, to me, I wouldn't want to be a supplier into the Altium powertrain. I wouldn't want to partner with it. I wouldn't want to be associated with the Altium project because it looks kind of disastrous. And I kind of think that if you keep saying you're bringing out cars on the Altium platform, there is going to be a level of cynicism about it. Just call it something else from this reset where they're going to sort it out and make sure that they do actually have the right equipment, that they have got things in place, that it is going to function. Because on the other hand, 99% of people walking into a dealership do not care. They're not going to be like, oh, is that their platform?
Yeah, we live in a bubble. We have to remind ourselves we live in a bubble, and that, you know, the majority of GM buyers are such high volume. They're just going to, walk into a dealership or not read that it's, Altium platform, this or that. They're just going in and getting a car.
I don't think it's a sales thing, but in terms of shareholders, like in terms of awkward meetings that you're going to have, I'd be calling it something else.
I would very much enjoy if in like 6 months GM goes, right, Altium is dead. Welcome, Mutlove or Mutlove.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's completely different. Malibu Stacy doesn't have a new hat. It's completely new. It strikes me that GM throughout all of this has gone into the EV creation process with the same confidence as that uncle or that dad that everyone knows, who is like, well, I did it myself in the old days, I can do it now, and ends up blowing up the boiler in their house or destroying the plumbing or electrocuting themselves ever so slightly and ending up in the ER going, well, I should have called a man. And everyone else is there screaming, going, come on, Uncle Jim.
Call
the guy. Solve the problem sensibly. Don't kill yourself.
This is a legacy automaker problem.
An element of that, and I think a lot of OEMs have somewhat done that. But I actually, and I know I've said this on the podcast before, but when they started specifically the Altium project, it seemed so much like GM was one of the few ones that knew that it needed to look, it needed to look into, for instance, grid provision. It needed to look at stuff like home charging. It needed to look at vehicle to grid. It needed to look at this holistic kind of entire environment, that the Altium products would be a range of solutions, that there'd be industrial solutions, and that they weren't just thinking like, how can we fire batteries into cars as fast as possible? Yeah. They were thinking, how can we make a genuinely good base product that's going to be how we move forward? And I honestly think probably Altium the pack, the sort of product that it is probably good, and the problems that they're encountering are manufacturing problems, efficiency and manufacturing problems, and like that is very unfortunate. I do think it's a hole they can get themselves out of, and that there isn't, that the Altium project isn't kind of like a terrible hubristic thing. It was actually something that was ambitious, but kind of did seem to have an awareness of the space.
I actually agree with you.
It has been damagingly slow.
When they first announced that whole thing, and was at CES, it was like a virtual presentation or whatever, and Mary Barra explained what Altium was going to be. It was like, oh my God, this is so exciting because this is exactly what we need in the EV space. And everything she was saying was like, yes, absolutely. Like, it's going to be modular and you're going to be able to, like, and then the products come out and it's like 200 some odd kilowatt hour battery. We're like, wait, what? Like, yeah. That is insane. But I think to your point that it's probably going to be reliable. So, I mean, we'll see. But it seems like it'll be a decent product once they get that stuff figured out. But yeah, it was very promising at the beginning.
I think it still is, right? And it's like, I'm glad you all brought up like the energy storage stuff that they want to do and the V2G stuff they're planning. Like this, they're doing some really exciting, ambitious things, or have some good plans. Like Hazel said, like going beyond slinging batteries into cars. Like this is a very holistic, smart approach that was planned as like, this is the future of our business for the next 100 years. And like, it's very easy to crap on GM. They make it very easy to do that sometimes, but it's like, no one wants to see them fail at this. I hope that they can get it together, because like, if they don't, I think of the jobs that are at risk, the manufacturing sector in this country that's at risk. If they don't, like, you know,
the number of EVs that you won't get on the market.
Yeah. Amen. Mm. Like, and just forget.
Cause like Lucid's not going to replace freaking Chevrolet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't, I don't think so anyway.
Not yet.
You know what I want to know is how much, like, this would be an interesting, I don't know if you want to do an article on this or something, Patrick, but you know what I want to know is what is the subsidy rate that they're getting in order to produce their EVs? Like, so they make, you know, the credits, obviously people can get the credits for the $7,500 to purchase them, but the automakers get a certain amount of money to produce batteries. So like, what really is their loss rate on that as far as what they're getting subsidized in order to create these EVs? Because the components and the materials and stuff like that, Ultium is its own thing. So they can, I believe, collect those subsidies in producing the batteries.
Yeah. And then you add in like things like the tax breaks to build the factories, which they're getting, you know, that was one of the really smart things the Biden administration did, was like they very heavily incentivized making this stuff in North America, you know, instead of, you know, China, obviously. Like, yeah, I kind of wonder what that is. But like, a lot of those costs are being defrayed by states and the federal government. But I mean, it's not like that's not happening elsewhere, right? I mean, like the Chinese government is bankrolling their EV revolution
over a decade. Yeah.
Oh yeah, like to a significant degree. I hope Ultium can get it together, but it's interesting. Yeah, you know, we did kind of plan this story. Like, John had been working on this for a while. We did kind of plan it this week when the Prologue came out, because I knew people were going to be talking about Ultium again. And that was the big question with the Honda Prologue, honestly. It's like, is this going to have the problems the Blazer did? And from our very limited experience, like, so far, it seems like it might be okay, but we won't know until it's on the road. And one thing I've sort of wondered about the Honda Prologue is how many of those customers for that car are going to know or care that it's a GM Ultium car underneath.
How many people know that a Suzuki Swace is actually a Toyota Corolla? Or other major badge swaps through time? Like, how many people
Supra and a BMW?
Yes, a Supra and a Z4, yeah.
Or even within the EV space, two cars that look basically identical, actually, if you sit them next to each other, most people don't know that Renault Zoes are Nissan Leafs.
Yeah. I know scores of like Hyundai and Kia owners who have no idea that those are like the same company. It's like, people don't know this stuff. Again, you get out of the bubble a bit, right? And I think Honda buyers especially, these are like no bullshit, no drama people. They buy that car because it functions, and it's a Honda. Like, you know, it's like they're gonna go to the dealer, like that's the Honda. I don't think that they are really gonna know too much about the ins and outs of Ultium. Like, you might get some small buyers who have really done the homework and the research, and maybe you're going to go for the Honda because it has CarPlay or Android Auto. But like, beyond that, I don't know if it matters for consumers.
I do think Honda is known for obviously their reliability, but also like being a relatively affordable cost point. And that's what I think is the only like, maybe people won't go with it because of that higher price point that this is. But I mean, you can't really, how are you going to avoid that?
If it's eligible for the tax credits, that might neutralize that a little bit.
I mean, I think people
if the other option is a Hyundai or a Kia, although they are base price cheaper cars, they don't get those incentives.
Design and too. And it looks, I think the Prologue seems like a little bit bigger than those two.
And the Prologue does have the advantage of being a Gennaro car. It's a lump of car.
Yes,
it is.
Yeah, I do think also that, you know, these Honda partnership cars might turn out to be the majority of Ultium cars that ever actually get out the door.
That's what's interesting.
As things stand.
They were like, we want 40,000 units this year, and they're like not backing down from it.
Mm.
Like, well, I think that's very interesting because Ultium is like, I mean, they're not even like the Mach-E last year was 40,000. I think was in that article that John said, like,
yeah.
Wow. That's ambitious.
Yeah. First year. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, like these are some big swings. I will say this. I wish I could have been a fly on the wall for whatever conversations must have happened where a bunch of Honda executives called in Japan, like to Detroit, to like ask like WTF is happening with your platform that we signed up to build. Like how much screaming was there? Like I want to know. Like I can't.
Yeah. They're not making Honda, that new affordable EV.
No screaming. But
so
there
they
would
cut,
have been
ties.
It would have been a very difficult conversation that said that, or it would have been a very difficult, very polite conversation. And at the end, they would have said that they were grateful to see that things were happening. But they wouldn't be moving forward with the second part of the contract.
Yeah, and they will. Honda will swear up and down. It's like, oh no, we just move the targets back. We're gonna do it. Now that things are slowing down a bit, we can wait and do our own program. But like, I'm pretty sure they looked at this and like, yeah, no, you don't get invited back to the party the next time we have one, guys. But thanks for playing. You know, I mean that
see you in another 20 years for the next Saturn view.
Yeah.
Now, so let's move on to a slightly more affordable fare that actually exists and has existed for a while, but has recently been facelifted.
I'd just like to clarify that we're about to have a segment, and I know a lot of people moan about this, where the two British people on the podcast really enthuse about a thing, because I know their complaints were too negative. So ready, everyone. Sit back.
Well, guess what? My favourite value, I said budget to their PR man a while ago, and he went, we're a value brand. A favourite value brand, Dacia, off of Romania, but actually France, and in this case, China, we'll explain in a minute, has launched the facelifted new version of the Dacia Spring. Now, don't get too excited, everyone, but basically...
I already am, Alex. That's the problem.
It gives me such deep joy. I love Dacias because they're so inoffensive and they're so workaday and they get that they are just there to be cars, but they're doing it in a fun way and not in like a zany, like children's entertainer fun way, just in a, we've got some cool stuff going on. Check this out.
And but selling
this
very well,
never
too,
tell
what
you
I
not
understand.
To do drugs.
Cheap doesn't have to mean cheerless. So the Dacia Spring, this is a sort of second generation. What do you get? Depending on where you buy it with various incentives, it could be as low as $13,000. In the UK, I think it's being pimped up for like, I think, £17,000-18,000. It's basically the same as the last one, but with some key differences. So it's got a 27 kilowatt hour battery gross. It'll do 140 miles on a charge, though they've said in the city you'll get more than that. There are two motors you can spec, 33 or 48 kilowatt hours. It's 44 to 64 horsepower. You can charge it at home or you can option in a 30 kilowatt hour charger, so you can, you know, do a fast charge on the way. What else do you get? It's based on Renault's CMF-A platform, same as the last one. The packaging's been fiddled with a bit, so now it doesn't only have a trunk, a 10.8 cubic foot trunk, it's also got a frunk, 1.23 cubic feet, which is about 35 liters, basically big enough for a cable and a squishy bag. If you want it, it will come in three trims: Essential, which only gets the little motor; Expression, which gets the small or the big one; or Extreme, which gets the big motor. You get all your Android Auto and your CarPlay. The whole thing's been given basically a pretty strong glow up. It looks absolutely mega for what it is, and it is tiny. It's only 146 inches long. So it's you know, you could lie down next to it and hug it, and it probably
you can get
work.
It into
how many
one
metric
of the...
goys?
How many? Well, we'll find out. Probably one and a bit.
But you could get that, like a car that small. You can get it next to any of the on-street slow chargers that are around my house. because it don't matter if someone's parked, as someone has for the last few days, a massive Nissan Juke right in the fucking way. Like, you'll still be able to get close enough because this car's tiny. You can tuck it into the tiny little bit on the end.
Yes, it's teeny, teeny, teeny. It's properly. I saw the last generation one last summer. So they bought one over.
Also,
and
it looks great.
It's coming. It looks like the old one looks good. This one looks better.
It looks great.
From their mad concepts that they threw around, was it last year? Mm,
the Manifesto concept, which is what their which was developed alongside their, sadly not EV, but biofuel-powered Sandrider Dakar rally raid car.
Yeah, yeah, because they basically released, like, what if Dachas, but in Halo.
Yeah.
It looks fantastic. The specs are great. I can't think of another car that has both a frunk and a manual handbrake like this thing does. So delightful as it is, if you can't buy a Dacia, you're sort of wondering, like, why do I care? I'll tell you why you care, because this is a small, affordable EV that's got great specs, and like, that's the next frontier for where this needs to go. Like, we've saturated the, you know, across the world, like, the $100,000 spaceship EV market. We need more cars like the Dacia Spring. And also, this is a super important car for its parent company, Renault, because in Europe, they are getting their lunch eaten by, like, cheap Chinese EVs coming into Europe. I was talking to Julian, who's one of Inside EV's reporters based in Romania. He's like, I can't even keep track of all the Chinese brands that people are buying. Like, it's like, and I do this for a living. And so, like, they're freaked out. Like, Volkswagen's freaked out. Stellantis is freaked out by the incursion of these Chinese cars to their market. And, like, the Dacia Spring is, like, one of those ones that's going to, like, you know, like tell BYD to, like, step outside or something at the bar. Like, this is
reject
their...
Reject modernity, embrace tradition, get your cheap cars from Eastern Europe.
Yes.
Well, amen. You say that. It is built in China, so it's designed and engineered in Eastern Europe, France. But
yeah.
But it is built in China.
I guess
that
sort of negates my point a little bit then. But hey, it works. It's from a European brand. You know,
it does the do. I mean, having read reviews of its direct predecessor, from which very little has changed. It's an exterior glow up. It's an interior glow up. The powertrain's the same, and it's got a bit more space. It's slightly shorter, I think. You know, it's a good car, and loads of people are going to balk at the fact that, oh, it doesn't go that far. Dacia says that, you know, Spring drivers do 23 miles. Average on a journey, so you don't need to worry that your range is 140 miles. Oh, it's got another couple of cool things I forgot. It's got vehicle to load, which is ace. I mean, not a lot of power, just 3.5 kilowatts, but enough to charge to do a kettle. And also, it's got this thing called a U-clip, which kind of, if we go back deep into mini lore, if you remember when the first Countryman came out, it had a rail that ran down the middle. If you had two seats in the back, it went all the way to the back of the car. If you had a bench in the back, it was just the front. And you could buy different attachments for it, so like a sunglasses holder, a cup holder, and you could customize it. U-clip sounds kind of similar to that. So you can have a phone holder or a cup holder or a this or a that. So you can, like, rather than them injection molding some nonsense space that doesn't quite fit a phone or doesn't quite fit, you know, your mug of tea in the morning or whatever it is you want, you can just buy the one that works for you. So they can make lots of them, and you can buy them at, you know, no money pounds at all to fit it, which just adds a little bit of personalization to the vehicle. I mean, it's tiny. It'll be offered in a limited color palette. You can see where they've tried to make it funky. The new Dacia logo looks great, I think. The design details that go with it are pretty cool. You know, their whole design language now, especially now, is super cohesive across their its range. Sorry, new Duster's coming out this year, which will be hybrid. Again, similar front graphics, so that big strong bar across the front of it. But don't get me wrong, this isn't going to be a car where you'll be like specking it for days, going, well, do I want this or do I want that? It's like, I want the one with the big motor and I want it in orange. Thanks. But, oh, I want a cup holder instead of a phone holder because it does CarPlay. Cars like this, for Europe especially, are going to be important so long as people can charge them. And it's the charging infrastructure side of things that's a problem. Hazel mentioned the charging lampposts that we have that used to be everywhere, and now people are taking them out for some reason, which is a massive pain. But this could be the perfect London car. I just need one and somewhere to plug it in, and it'd be great.
I look at this and, you know, like the Chevy Bolt is coming back on Ultium. Like, hopefully they get their issues together there. It's like, I hope the next Bolt, which is going to be like an Ultium based like heavy update of the current car, I hope it's kind of like this. Like, it's like small and affordable. It's got some neat little quirks to it and features, and it's practical and cheap. Like, this is a good template for the kinds of cars that we need more of in the US too. And it's like, they gave this thing is not, it doesn't look like some soulless appliance. It looks fun. It's got like goofy stuff about it and fun features. Like, this is, it has some joy. And I don't know, this is a really wonderful package all around. And I think that, you know, if you live in Europe, you should give this thing a look. I think
it looks more distinctive than a lot of other EVs.
Yeah.
Like, hell yeah. Like, in terms of like having a little personality and like, I think, as much as people aren't massively familiar with the Dacia brand, despite the success of the Duster, I think it's a very likable car. And in particular, if you're like, this is the kind of car where if you're thinking, God, I need to bin off my car because it's no longer compliant with whatever pollution requirements in my city, like whether that's London, whether that's Paris, wherever the hell, then, and again, like Paris cracking down on big cars, like there's a lot of places where this will start looking like an incredibly attractive prospect, because it will be the car you can park on your road. You don't have to worry too much about charging it all the time. You don't like need to, but on those times where you do need to drive 140 miles to somewhere, it's there, which are rare occasions.
Yes, it's very rare occasions. Well, this leads us neatly to our next story, which is, Dacia said spring drivers only tend to do 23 miles. Now, a study by Recurrent found out that actually you don't need a 600 million mile range from your EV, because your average journey in that there Murica, depending on state, admittedly, is 20 to 45 miles. So that's 18 to 16% of your average EPA range. Depending on state, obviously. So Alaska, Texas, and California is below average, but they did note that people there might probably have a petrol alternative, be it pure ICE or BEV. I did a little bit of looking into this just for the Euro side of things. In the UK, commutes are average at 19.5-20 miles. That's down from what it used to be quite dramatically. I think post-pandemic, a lot of people have just gone, well, I don't do 40 miles a day now. I do 40 miles every other day or twice a week or something like that, which has brought the numbers down. But it does, it's a wonderful data point of like, yes, I know it would feel nice to not have to plug this thing in every night and hope for the best, but actually you don't need to. You don't need to worry about this stuff. And it's hopefully a prod that a lot of people will kind of get the hint and then stop worrying. What do we think, friends?
I think this is always a difficult one, because they're like, I think most people know that they do not actually drive very far during their day. And there's always someone who's like, actually, my commute is 150 miles each way. And it's like, no, it isn't. Like, or if it is, it shouldn't be. Like, move house. What are you doing? The majority of us are probably aware that you know, there's entire days when we don't move our cars or trucks. And that a lot of the time, the average journey tends to be fairly local. You tend to be going to get groceries. You tend to be going like to the town next over or something. And although this isn't the case for absolutely everyone, there are some people who live very remotely. For the majority of people, that will be, you know, sub 100 miles round trip, even if you're talking like a pretty long one. And the thing that people always kind of throw in is like, but once a year I drive to wherever, and that's an 800 mile round trip, and I'd have to stop to charge three times, and you know, whatever. I feel like although you can kind of emphasize, like, daily you will not need to worry about this. This is where that blend of home and fast charging comes in, where it's like, yes, daily you really don't need to worry about it. You can just plug it in, it can trickle charge. You'll have, like, you don't ever need to worry about where the gas station is or if it's open again, or stopping on some sketchy road to do that. But when you need to do that 400 mile journey, yes, you'll need to work out where the fast chargers are, and the car will help you do it, and here's all the tools that we've given you. I'll shut up, but like I always think with these things, it's like the average case scenario is not like people's anxiety tends to be about the extremities more than because I don't think,
well, if we just
aside from when I had a really old car, I didn't really worry about driving 20 miles, you know?
Yeah. If we just jump into the comments real quick, Dave Kruger on YouTube says the average trip argument is old and silly. Most people will never buy a car that can cover 80% of their use cases. People want a car for everything, whether that makes sense or not. What do we think?
I think that the problem is like you're saying, Hazel, is that yes, you're going to get most of your use case by plugging in at home. And in my opinion, you probably shouldn't get an EV if you don't have convenient overnight charging, because you don't want it to make it an inconvenient life experience. But for the rest of the people, like for me, I'm a very abnormal EV driver. I almost always am doing road trips instead of a daily commute. So the fact that was the old argument of saying, like, oh yeah, well, I need to get one that's within the range that I would need even if I have to do road trips. But the fact is, right now, like, unless you live in like North Dakota or something like that, there are so many DC fast chargers that people don't realize. Like, just look on PlugShare for DC fast chargers only and you'll see that they're everywhere. You can pretty much go wherever in the country. Excuse me. Even like years ago, I've driven across the country, and like back in when I was on Charge Across America on NBC Sports, the rally that went from New York to LA, like we went in a Mustang Mach-E, which, I mean, it was like less than 300 miles of range in total for its range figures, but we could go across the country. Like at this stage, you can go across the country. You can pretty much go anywhere you want. It is just going to take you a little bit longer. And maybe you plan it out to where you plan your less charging stops for DC fast charging if you're going on a really long trip, and stop at a hotel and overnight charge and get a full charge when you're there, so you're not inconveniencing yourself so much.
I also think that the challenge here is that, like, read the comments on this story that Suvrat wrote. They're fascinating. And like, this is not a compelling argument to get people into EVs. Like, you need less than you think. Like, especially in America, there is like a real knee-jerk reaction to people being told what they need. Like, it's just like, we were repeatedly called fascists in the comment section there. And we're not. We're super cool and fun to hang out with. We are definitely not fascists. And it's just like, I don't know, there's just like, yeah, there's like, there are people that are just like, if you're telling me I only need this, like, screw you. I want what I want. And it has to cover 100% of use cases. And there is one reader in that story who commented, and I actually don't disagree with this person. It was like, the data comes from Recurrent was limited to people who have selected EVs already. You're excluding all the people who need to drive more because they might not purchase an EV or they're skeptical about it. And it's just like, I statistically, data-wise, energy use-wise, practical in a sense of practicality, this is all accurate what they're saying. But it's just, it doesn't sell people on going electric, unfortunately.
Right.
It's like the climate change argument. Like, Americans do not care. They just, like, by and large, don't care. So,
and they naturally think of like the gas experience of, oh, I go and I just fill up because there's a gas station on every corner. So whenever I need it, I'll just go stop and I'll take the 5 minutes to go and fill up on gas. But when you own an EV, it's different because you can charge in way different spaces and areas. So like, maybe if you're going to the grocery store once a week and your grocery store has a charger, then you just match your dwell time with the amount of charging time that you would need. You wouldn't need to stop at a DC fast charger because you're taking, you know, maybe an hour or so, or maybe you would because you're only going in for 10 minutes. But to match our activities with the charging experience is more of the, you know, easier, more convenient way of owning an EV than what we're used to with gas.
Yeah, and also because, I mean, because if you actually think about the gas experience, it's quite inconvenient. That, like, you can't, you, if you get to your home and you've only got a little bit left, and then, you know, something happens in the middle of the night and you're like, oh God, I need to leave. But the gas station's closed because it's 2 a.m. or whatever, like, then actually that is quite inconvenient and, like, can leave you stranded or, like, in a stressful situation. And, like, for sure, I have been sitting there thinking, like, well, if this traffic goes on for much longer, then I don't know quite what we're using in the car anymore. And there's a reason that there's been a popular rise in EVs every time that there's been an oil crisis, because suddenly you get the availability anxiety about gas, and people are like, whoa, I need something else. And there's been this switch on, switch off rise of EVs that's now proving irrevocable because the oil has to be switched off. But hopefully, you know, let's see what happens. But yeah, I think showing, I mean, I for one can't wait to drive my Dacia Spring to Peckham Lidl and plug it into the fast chargers that are at, or the reasonably fast chargers that are at my local budget supermarket. But there are these, I mean, exactly as Lacey says, it's just like showing how much more convenient having something where you have pretty much total control over the range.
Yeah.
Like, and also, and this is a weird thing, but you can charge your EV in a lot of circumstances at home if you don't have the dollars in your wallet to be able to go and like get gas. And like, if you need to get to work and you're getting paid at the end of the week, then you can still charge the EV because the bill's going to come out a bit later. And like, this is the kind of thing I have to think about. And like, that is actually quite convenient that you can kind of like delay it a little bit. And obviously it involves the privilege of having an EV or leasing an EV or being given a fleet EV by your work or like whatever. But like, there are some significant advantages in terms of convenience and also in terms of like managing that supply by yourself and not being, you know, under big shell, literally.
Mm-hmm. And on that most salient of points, that brings us to an end of another Inside EVs podcast. A huge thanks to Lacey, Miss Go Electric, Hazel Southwell, and the boss man, Patrick George. Also to our lovely producer in the background, Danny Howard, who's been making everything go all swishy on your screens. If you want to get in touch with us, I'm sure you can find us on social media or drop us an email at contact@insideevs.com. For now, we're going to have a lovely weekend, and I suggest you do too. See you next week, friends. Bye.
Bye, everyone. Bye. Thanks for listening. Thanks.
At Ability Chiropractic, we do things differently. We believe lasting health starts with understanding how your body truly works, not masking pain with quick fixes. Our doctors take the time to educate and empower you to take control of your wellness journey. Through gentle, customized adjustments, we help restore proper function and unlock your body's natural healing power. That's why Columbus families have trusted Ability Chiropractic since 2012. See the difference for yourself. Book an appointment today at abilitychiro.com.
Are we exposed? This is what every security team is wondering. But with vulnerabilities scattered across network, cloud, AI, and OT silos, the truth is out of reach, and attackers know it. There's a better way. Unify to defy risk with Tenable AI-powered exposure management. Tenable brings together all your security data and exposures in one unified view, giving you the attacker's map and revealing the critical paths and weaknesses they can exploit. Now your teams can prioritize intelligently, move decisively, and collaborate without friction. Tenable turns scattered work into a single proactive force. Instead of chasing noise, your team knows where to focus, gaining clarity, control, and speed to reduce cyber risk with confidence. Learn more at Tenable.com. Tenable, your exposure ends here.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. we are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.